On this episode of Skeptico, EEG expert Dr. John Greenfield.
So when the brain is not getting much blood, it pretty much shuts down. In that time when it's not getting very much, there's really very little activity going on, and it'd be very unlikely that somebody could have a complex sort of dreamlike state as described for most near-death experiences, at least during that time.
And near-death experience researcher, Dr. Penny Sartori.
What I did is the people who had a near-death experience and the out-of-body experience, what they recorded was really quite accurate. And I decided then to ask the control group, the people who'd actually had a cardiac arrest but had no recollection of anything at all, I asked them if they would reenact their resuscitation scenario and tell me what they thought that we had done to resuscitate them. And what I found is that many of the patients couldn't even guess as to what we'd done. They had no idea at all. And then some of them did make guesses, but these were based on TV hospital dramas that they'd seen. And I found that what they reported was widely inaccurate.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and I want to start by thanking those of you who've contacted me directly since the last episode of Skeptico and have joined me on Facebook or joined me on Twitter. It's been great to get to know you, to dialogue a little bit, and I hope we can keep that going. So any of you who are interested in connecting with the show, connecting with me, please feel free. Drop me a note on either by email, many of you did that, or Facebook, Twitter, follow me on Twitter, whatever you like. And let's try and further this effort of really building a community of folk who are interested in approaching these topics we cover on Skeptico in an open-minded way that is critical of both bunky science as well as bunky skeptics, because that's really our agenda here. But let's get on to today's episode, because today we have two very interesting interviews that address the near-death experience topic. And we're going to dig into a couple issues that have been coming up in the previous episodes of Skeptico. Now, as a little bit of a background, if you wind up talking about near-death experience with any well-informed skeptics, your dialogue is likely to go in a couple of directions. First, any well-informed skeptic is going to acknowledge the existence of the near-death experience phenomena. At this point, case studies have been published in the New England Journal of Medicine, Journal of Psychiatry, just about every major medical journal. So there's no getting around the phenomena. Well-informed skeptics will focus on instead are two issues. The first centers around the issue of whether the near-death experiencer really is brain dead. So for example, on the last episode of Skeptico, you heard from Dr. Michael Persinger, and he made a claim that I've heard several times before, and it seemed very absurd to me, but a lot of folks wanted me to pursue it, so I did. And that's the claim that even though someone may be presenting a flat EEG, they still may be having a near-death experience, a complex, coherent, dreamlike hallucination, but it just isn't showing up on their EEG. Now, again, I think that idea is way out there, but we're going to have a guest come on and address that issue a little bit. Now, the second point that your well-informed skeptic is likely to make about near-death experience is the timing issue. So they're likely to kind of postulate that maybe they were having this near-death experience when their brain was back online, and they're just remembering it and they're thinking it happened when they were brain dead, but it really didn't happen that way. And for that, I have a very interesting interview with Dr. Penny Sartori, who's done some very, very interesting research that I've referenced before, but never really had a chance to talk with her directly. So we'll hear from her. But first, let's get to this short interview I did with a professor of neurology at the University of Toledo, very highly regarded guy, Dr. John Greenfield. I'm fortunate enough to have on the phone Dr. John Greenfield from the University of Toledo, who is the author of Reading EEGs, A Practical Approach, and he has a list of qualifications about as long as I could, as long as my arm, as they say. So I'm going to ask Dr. Greenfield to tell us a little bit about your background, what you do there at the University of Toledo, and your qualifications in terms of addressing questions about EEG use.
Okay. Again, my name is John Greenfield. I'm a professor of neurology at the University of Toledo College of Medicine, and I have trained in both neurology and clinical neurophysiology and EEG, so I'm board certified in reading EEG, so I suppose that's my qualification.
Great. So I contacted you because, as folks who listen to this show regularly know, we've been kind of delving into EEGs because they crop up when we start looking at near-death experience and possible explanations for what's going on in someone's brain. So what I really wanted to focus on, and you provided a great insight in your email, is this question of whether it's likely that a near-death experiencer is having a complex near-death experience, as it's described, without anything showing up on their EEG?
Well, as I mentioned to you before, I think the likelihood of that is pretty low. Most patients, when the EEG is flat, when it's not showing any activity, that really suggests that the brain is not doing very much, and the likelihood of having any sort of experience at all in that setting is pretty low.
You referenced in your email to me, you said it's very unlikely that a hypoperfused brain with no evidence...
Right. So when the brain is not getting much blood, it pretty much shuts down. And whether that ends up being permanent depends on how long the blood flow is shut off. But in that time when it's not getting very much, there's really very little activity going on, and it'd be very unlikely that somebody could have a complex sort of dreamlike state as described for most near-death experiences, at least during that time.
Right, and you kind of alluded to both human studies, and I was alluding to animal studies that would back up that conclusion. Is that right? Do you want to elaborate on that at all?
Well, so there are a few studies. There's not much really published on this very much, but when we suspect that patients may be brain dead or very near brain death, and they have flat EEGs, often we've done studies to look at blood flow to the brain or glucose utilization in the brain, and there are a few radioisotope kind of tracer studies that let you look at those questions, and very often they show very little brain activity. So a flat EEG typically correlates with a very inactive brain.
Great. Well, that's exactly what we were kind of driving at. So thanks again for joining us today on Skeptico for this short little interview. And for those folks who are interested more in this topic, would the book that you've published, Reading EEGs, I take it that's more of a technical manual for neurologists?
It's really an introduction for neurologists and EEG fellows and people who read EEGs to get them educated in how to do that.
Well, we'll definitely point people to that if they are interested. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks very much.
Okay, that should really put this issue to rest. You know, he's a little bit circumspect in the first answer that he gives, but really as he gets into it more and more, you can tell he's trying to couch it in careful medical scientific terms and not being completely certain. But in the dialogue that I had with him and in the email exchange with him, he made it quite clear that it just makes no sense to suggest that someone is having a near-death experience as we generally understand it, and they're having a flat EEG. That's a dead issue. If you're pushing that, you better bring some new fantastic data because it contradicts everything we know about how the brain works. Okay, so on to issue two, and that is, could the near-death experiencer be remembering things after their brain is back online? That is, not during the time while they're having a flat EEG. Now, some very good research that directly addresses this issue has been done by Dr. Penny Sartori, who was working under Dr. Peter Fenwick, who you've heard on this show before. Now, Dr. Sartori was nice enough to join me for an interview today, and the interview starts with me kind of jumping right in, and you'll hear her response to the email question that I sent her regarding whether Michael Persinger's claim of the flat EEG could possibly be true. And you'll hear her say, you know, very proper in qualifying, say, you know, we really don't know and maybe not and who knows. But as you just heard, if you really talk to a neurologist, if you really look at any of the evidence, it that really doesn't make any sense. But listen to that and then listen to the other parts of what she has to say about her research. Fascinating stuff. Here goes.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, really, what he said. And, you know, he is, at the moment, he's quite right. We don't know with EEGs. It does only measure the surface of the brain functioning. So, yeah, sure, there could very well be deeper processing going on that we're unaware of at this present time. That's why it's so important to continue with this sort of research, really, to find out more and answer these questions.
To me, that's inadequate, and it feels like so much of the time we spend time, sometimes we spend time on the other guy's playing field, if you will. I mean, Dr. Persinger, I had a delightful conversation with him, and he's very knowledgeable in his view of things, working with the God helmet and all that. But to me, he's suggesting a whole different interpretation of the way the brain works, particularly with such lucid, coherent experiences as are reported in the near-death experience. And then to suggest that that wouldn't show up in an EEG, in my understanding, my limited kind of hobbyist understanding of it, goes against all the human research on EEGs, plus some really more tightly controlled animal research on EEGs and how the brain works. I don't know how you can proclaim that if you're him and suggest, well, there's some big mystery out there that we haven't solved in terms of how the brain works.
Yeah, at the moment, we really don't have such a great understanding of how the brain works, especially in relation to consciousness. And I think, you know, the current neuroscientists are looking at the brain from our current viewpoint that consciousness is a byproduct of the brain. And I think the more research that we're doing into near-death experience is showing that perhaps this view of consciousness is perhaps not correct. It could be that rather than consciousness being a byproduct of the brain, maybe the consciousness is just mediated through the brain.
To me, that seems obvious, an obvious interpretation of the results. Even, you know, Dr. Persinger, and I don't want to focus our entire interview on the follow-up with what he had, but, you know, he suggested that some of his other work has been highly suggestive that telepathic communication happens and he connects two people up to the God helmet in different rooms and flashes light on one and it shows up on the EEG of the other, kind of replicating the Ganzfeld work that's been done by Dean Radin and a number of other people. So I guess the question would be, aren't we ready to kind of overturn that mind equals brain model, or do we have to still kind of carry it around and defer to the existing belief that so many neuroscientists have that to me just seems completely overrun by the data that is mounting daily that comes in?
Yeah, I think you're quite right there. You know, the more research that is being done is showing that our view, current, is really perhaps inadequate. And I think it's really exciting that all this research is being done because it's showing and it's given us new answers as well, and it's given us new avenues to pursue. And so I think it's really important to continue with this research. And as you quite rightly said, it is an overwhelming database there now showing us that these things perhaps we need to take forward, and perhaps, you know, we need to review our current views of science.
You know, Dr. Sartori, one of the most fascinating pieces of research in this whole area is some work that you did with patients who had been recently resuscitated from cardiac arrest, and then you asked them to recount the resuscitation process. For those folks who maybe aren't familiar with that research, and can you tell us a little bit about why you embarked on that research and what you discovered when you did that survey?
Sure, yeah. I work as a nurse in the intensive care unit, and because of the nature of my job, of course, I come across a lot of death. And, of course, you see so much death, it just makes you wonder what happens when we die. And it was a patient in particular who I was looking after that really upset me a lot, and it made me ask these philosophical questions about life and about death. And I started reading about near-death experiences, well, death, and then I came across near-death experiences, and I thought, wow, these people are telling us that death is nothing to be frightened of. And I thought to myself, well, with regards to my scientific training as a nurse, I just thought that these experiences were just some sort of hallucination or some sort of wishful thinking as you come close to death. And indeed, I remember as a student nurse, a patient confiding in me about her near-death experience. And at the time, I listened to her, but I didn't think that there was anything in it. I just thought it was some sort of hallucination on her behalf. And although I listened, I didn't actually ask any further questions because I didn't think that there could be anything true about this experience. And it was only later, when I actually started reading about near-death experiences, that I realized what this lady had told me. And I just thought, well, I'm working in the, you know, perfect environment to research these experiences. So I decided to undertake my own research project, and for 5 years I gathered data where I spoke to people who had been patients in the intensive care unit, and particularly focused on patients who'd had a cardiac arrest. So these patients had been clinically dead for some period of time, in that their heart had stopped beating and blood wasn't circulating around their bodies. And when these patients revived, as soon as they were medically fit, I approached them and I introduced myself and I asked them the simple question, did you have any memory of the time that you were unconscious? Now, a lot of these patients didn't remember anything at all, but there were a few patients who did report some very interesting experiences. And this is something that really does fascinate me. In total, out of the during the 5 years, I interviewed over 300 patients. Not all of these patients had had a cardiac arrest, because during the first year, I interviewed everyone who had been a patient and survived in the intensive care unit, regardless of how close to death they came. And I wanted to see if maybe just the thought that they could be close to death could in itself precipitate an experience. And this didn't seem to be the case. And then for the next 4 years, I concentrated solely on the patients who had had a cardiac arrest and so had survived clinical death. And what I found is that although the sample was a lot smaller than the first year's data, I found that quite a large group of these people did report experiences consistent with a near-death experience.
And what about the work that you did in comparing their recollections of the resuscitation process versus the control group being people who hadn't recalled any near-death experience?
Yeah, that's right. Well, what I did was the people who had a near-death experience and the out-of-body experience, what they recorded was really quite accurate. And I decided then to ask the control group, the people who'd actually had a cardiac arrest but had no recollection of anything at all, I asked them if they would reenact their resuscitation scenario and tell me what they thought that we had done to resuscitate them. And what I found is that many of the patients couldn't even guess as to what we'd done. They had no idea at all. And then some of them did make guesses, but these were based on TV hospital dramas that they'd seen. And I found that what they reported was widely inaccurate. And some people just made educated guesses. And what I found was that some people were sort of under the misconception that they had had a DC shock, when in fact they had only had chest compressions and drugs administered. And then the ones who did have a DC shock, I found that the patients guessed the wrong position of where these shock paddles would be placed on the body. So there was a stark contrast, really, in the very accurate out-of-body experiences reported and then the guesses that the control group had made.
You know, Dr. Sartori, in the past, I've spoken with a couple of guests who've worked in hospice, either as a nurse or physicians who've worked with people who are close to death. And what they've reported is that the culture and the common understanding among people who work with folks who die, they just have a different sensitivity and a different openness to this kind of information. I'm wondering if you've found that in intensive care. Are doctors and nurses who've worked with a lot of patients who've passed or passed and come back, are they more accepting of this this kind of strange survival of consciousness phenomena?
Yes, certainly. When I was my first day on the ward as a student nurse, I can remember we were having handover in the office from the shift before us, and the nurse had handed over. She said, "The man in bed two, he'll die shortly because he's already started communicating with his dead mother." Now, I thought this was something to scare me because it was my first day on the ward. But I looked around and the other nurses just carried on as if this was something normal. And then, lo and behold, within 2 or 3 hours of the shift beginning, this man actually did die. And that is something that's always stuck with me. And certainly throughout my training and my career as a nurse, when I worked on the wards, when patients were expected to die, it was common to see them communicating with people that we couldn't see. For example, very often they'd have big smiles on their faces, or they'd be gesturing to someone that we can't see. And it's not quite so common in intensive care because a lot of the patients towards the end of their life are sedated. But certainly for patients who are not sedated and are coming to the end of their life, that is something that has been witnessed by many nurses and many doctors, and it is very much accepted.
You know, I find that kind of disparity between medical knowledge on folks who are working with folks who are close to dying and those who are not as being just another interesting aspect of this whole puzzle. I mean, one of the things that in this whole field that just intrigues me is how there can be this willful ignorance on the part of so many folks who really should know better about this phenomena. And I wonder if you have any thoughts or explanation for why there is this seemingly unexplainable lack of acceptance and knowledge about this. Obviously, it's a controversial area, it's a scary area, but why can't we get closer to it from a scientific, medical standpoint? And I know we are inching closer to it, but it just seems like it's such slow, slogging through the mud kind of progress.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people are just sort of very much set in their ways, perhaps, and they don't think about things like this. You know, it's only when I actually started thinking deeply about death that I got a real interest in these sort of experiences. Prior to that, I just thought, oh no, I just dismissed them and just thought, no, these are just hallucinations. There can't be any truth in them. But I think, you know, it's only when you start looking at them very deeply and you start thinking a lot about them, and then you relate what you read and what you see to what you actually encounter in the work area of the hospital. So I think a lot of people certainly don't think very deeply about it, and they're not exposed to it either. You know, not many people work as people do. Obviously, there are doctors and nurses who don't believe in these sort of things and just continue to dismiss them. But I think a lot of people are still sort of entrenched in that belief system that these things can't possibly be true. And you know, it's only recently, really, that this sort of research is becoming quite foremost and being quite, it's sort of like taking off this sort of research, really, compared to what it's been in the past.
Right. And we can only hope that it'll continue in that direction and really catch up with the public, because I think the public has been much more accepting of this phenomena as a whole than has the medical community and the scientific community, which also leads into, maybe you want to comment on what I perceive as a certain disenchantment that the public has with science in general. And you don't see it in all areas. Certainly, I think people are very accepting of the wonderful technological toys that we have. But I think this, especially maybe more in the States than in Europe and in the UK, but there's this sense that gee, science, if you haven't solved this thing that I know is real because someone in my family had it or someone very close to me experienced this, then how can I be so sure that you're right about some of your other conclusions? I wonder if you have any comments on this disenchantment that many experience with the scientific explanation when they encounter directly experiences like this that science up until very recently has been very closed to explaining.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do become disenchanted really with science's perceptions and current stance on these things. But I think a lot of people now are looking for explanations, alternative explanations, if you like. And I think that perhaps this is why this sort of research is so popular with people out there, you know, the general public, because they want answers and they're not satisfied with the current scientific explanations because of experiences that they've had or encountered with members of their own family. So I think, you know, a lot of people are looking for other answers as well.
Yeah. So thanks so much for joining us. Tell us what's coming up for you in terms of future research or maybe writing projects.
Well, I'm currently sort of working on more writing. I'm working on a mainstream book to do with my research. And I'm currently involved with the Global Aware Project, which is headed by Dr. Sam Parnia.
Right.
You've probably heard of this project, have you? It's basically a global scale project on the work that I did.
Yes, no, we had Dr. Fenech on the show several months ago, and he talked about it. And maybe you want to tell us a little bit about your involvement in that and what you see coming up with that and when we might expect to see some early results from that.
Well, the hospital research is underway at the moment. It's been up and running for approximately 2 years, and it's gathering data from different hospitals throughout the UK. I think there's about 15 hospitals from the UK involved. There's hospitals from America. There's hospitals in Vienna and other parts of Europe taking part in this research. And we hope to get a large database of people who have had cardiac arrest and examine the sort of experiences that they have had and the impact that these experiences have on their life as well. And we're hoping to publish something on this project sometime in the next few months, hopefully.
Wow, well, that's great. I didn't realize there's going to be some early findings were going to be out that soon. So that's certainly exciting to look for that.
Yes, yeah. But you'll have to speak to Dr. Sam Parnia about that. He's heading that aspect of it.
Well, thanks again so much for joining us. Very interesting work, and we certainly wish you well with it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks again for joining me today on Skeptico. As I mentioned earlier, please reach out, connect with me, join me on Facebook, join me on Twitter, drop me an email. I've really enjoyed the opportunity to meet some of you in the last week and connect with you, and I hope we can further build a community of folks who are interested in approaching these topics in the same way and in the way that we do here on Skeptico. And of course, if you're interested in any of our previous shows, check out the Skeptico website. That's at Skeptiko, don't forget the K in there, .com. And you'll find everything you need to link up to us there. So that's going to do it for today. Got some more interesting shows coming up, just trying to get them out as fast as I can. I actually have quite a few interesting interviews that have already been completed and are kind of in the bin waiting to come out. But it's just a matter of putting enough hours into getting it all out. So bear with me, stay with me. And until then, bye for now.